At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The official score, the budget impact for the GOP healthcare plan runs 28 pages. The devil, as always, however, is in the details. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosdahl. Monday, the 13th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The ugly truth about government economic policy is that it often reduces real-life issues to numbers on a spreadsheet. Today's example is the GOP replacement for Obamacare, the American Health Care Act, it's called. The Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, released its long-awaited score for that plan this afternoon. Its estimate of what the bill is actually going to do. Sarah Cliff covers health care for Vox. Sarah, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Give me the headlines on this one. What's the big takeaway for you?
So the big takeaway is this is a very bad CBO report for Republicans. The agency is estimating that 24 million people would lose coverage under the Republican plan. This is way worse than what most analysts were expecting. They were thinking would be in the 10 to 15 million range. And this is going to be yet another obstacle for the Republicans' plans to repeal and replace Obamacare.
Do you not suppose, though, that we will hear more from Republicans about the fact that the budget deficit drops by $337 billion instead of the people losing coverage?
Yeah, I'm curious to see what we hear. You know, before this, we saw the Trump administration really trying to discredit CBO, saying, you know, this is an agency that got some Obamacare projections wrong. We shouldn't necessarily trust them. So it'll be interesting to see, do they seize on the numbers they like? Do they just say, well, this is, you know, a bogus agency that has done bad numbers before? Everything that everyone else is going to want to talk about is that 24 million number. That's really big. And we'll see kind of where the Trump administration wants to take the conversation.
Am I right that most of the budget deficit reduction on this bill comes from decreased spending on Medicaid? I mean, a bunch of it.
Yeah. So this report, it shows an $880 billion cut to Medicaid. A lot of that is from freezing enrollment in the Medicaid expansion in 2020, which would eventually, you know, lead to a lot less spending because you're covering a lot fewer people. And they also generally just want to change the Medicaid formula for funding so that states are getting less money. So a lot of this really is being driven by a big cut to Medicaid. And kind of the reason the deficit is being reduced is because you're covering fewer people with health care.
Let's take this to the voters for a second. You went out to Kentucky not too long ago and talked to people who were on Obamacare about what they thought of the president's promise to get rid of it. Tell me what you found.
So I found a lot of Obamacare enrollees who voted for Trump who thought it was just campaign bluster. They had heard Trump's promises to repeal Obamacare, and they said, well, he's not going to do that. And if he does that, you know, he won't take our health insurance. He'll pass something better, something more affordable. And I think, you know, for me, the CBO report, it kind of shows that this promise that Trump has made so many times that, you know, he'll cover everybody, that nobody's going to leave and nobody is going to lose insurance, it really, you know, proves that false. The plan that Republicans have crafted, it will no doubt cover millions fewer Americans than currently have coverage under Obamacare.
Is there any doubt in your mind, though, that the Republicans still get this through at least the House? Let's set aside the Senate for a second.
Yeah, so I think they still have a chance. Never say never, right? The Affordable Care Act was declared dead, you know, a dozen times in the process of drafting it. I remember I was looking at old blog posts I wrote back then saying, you know, this law doesn't stand a chance. So I will not make those projections. But it's going to be hard, and you kind of question what Republicans are doing here. Kind of what is their goal with this bill? Because it's certainly, you know, not to expand coverage or even keep the expansion from the Affordable Care Act.
Sarah Cliff, she covers healthcare for Vox. She is the one to follow, by the way, if you want healthcare policy information. Sarah, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
That CBO score dropped after the closing bell. Intentional, I'd guess, if I were a betting man, which I'm not. Traders had one eye on the Fed. Anyway, it meets tomorrow. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. With the great blizzard of 17 bearing down on the East Coast, it's anybody's guess as to what's going to be open for business tomorrow and Wednesday in Washington, D.C. I'm only mentioning that because, you know, the Federal Open Market Committee is scheduled to meet tomorrow and Wednesday and is widely, and by widely, I mean basically universally, expected to raise interest rates. President Trump and Fed Chair Janet Yellen have had, shall we say, an up-and-down relationship dating back to the days of the campaign. He accused her of keeping interest rates low to help President Obama. He has also said raising interest rates would be a disaster for the economy. To be fair, he has also said he has great respect for Dr. Yellen. So, bygones, I guess. But historically, relations between the Fed and the White House are often tense, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour explains.
LBJ, Nixon, Carter, Reagan, they've all beat up on the Fed.
We have a number of times in throughout history where the Fed and the president are at odds.
Robert Barbera is at Johns Hopkins. Presidents typically want lots of jobs, fast growth. It's what they campaign on. So they don't typically want interest rates to rise and interfere with all that.
Most famously, you know, Richard Nixon apparently tried to pressure the Fed to not hurt the economy before his reelection.
Joe Gagnon is at the Peterson Institute. George H.W. Bush blamed his failure to get reelected on then-Fed Chair Alan Greenspan, saying he didn't cut interest rates enough. But that kind of tension has been rare since the 90s. In part, it's because Alan Greenspan fought back, causing presidents to reconsider picking fights with the Fed. And rates have been very low now for almost a decade. Raising them a little does not have to hurt the economy. Randy Krosner is a former Fed governor and teaches at Chicago's Booth School of Business.
The Fed raising rates approximately three times this year would be consistent with the greater optimism about growth prospects for the U.S. economy.
There are, however, ingredients for a showdown. The Fed thinks the economy will grow this year a little faster than it would like to see. Not a big deal for now. But if the Trump administration adds on tax cuts and deficit spending, that could truly overheat the economy and cause inflation, prompting the Fed to raise rates faster. Again, Robert Barbera at Johns Hopkins.
The bang together of heads comes if you get that kind of growth and you're getting into a place where you have to begin to worry about inflation pretty soon down the road.
We are not there yet. Inflation is still under target. We don't know whether we're going to get massive deficit spending. We don't know what tax cuts will look like. The range of possible outcomes, says Barbera, is as wide as he's ever seen it. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
President Trump had his first official cabinet meeting this afternoon. Also on his agenda was the signing of an executive order titled A Comprehensive Plan for Reorganizing the Executive Branch. The White House says it's going to make government more efficient, effective, and accountable. Those are their words. It's not the first time a president has done something like this. See also Bill Clinton and Al Gore. But as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports, this plan is more about making good on campaign promises than about budget austerity.
The last time we saw an attempt to shrink the federal workforce this much was during the Clinton administration, when there was a 20% reduction.
That would be about 400,000 people.
Morley Winograd played a key role in this process as a policy director to Vice President Al Gore. One distinction, he says, Clinton's budget didn't seek outright cuts.
We looked for places where we could change the way the government functions and reduce headcount as a result of those changes.
Unlike President Trump, Winograd says the Clinton budget did not target specific agencies. Lindsay Kashgarian is research director at the National Priorities Project.
Another thing to notice is that those cuts were actually pretty short-lived.
Kashgarian says during the 1990s, the federal government benefited from a booming economy and significant drawdowns in defense spending.
But by the time you got to 1998, all of those cuts had actually been restored, and federal non-defense spending was back up to what it had been a few years earlier.
Heritage Foundation economist Steve Moore says cuts of 15% to 20% to some agencies should be doable, just as they were a few years ago under mandatory sequester cuts.
Then it turned out that these agencies, when they were forced to, were able to suck in their stomachs and tighten their belts and become more efficient.
However, Moore notes, Trump's budget does not touch the biggest part of government spending, Social Security, and does not reduce the deficit. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
President Trump's big speech to Congress last month, there was a single moment when he alluded to the space program. American footprints on distant worlds are not too big a dream, the president said. The current NASA authorization bill gives the space agency $19.5 billion to spend this year, some of which might eventually be spent getting humans to the closest distant world. That would be Mars. Rebecca Boyle is a science journalist and a contributor to 538. She's been writing about the Mars program lately. Rebecca, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We should point out here at the beginning that the thing that made NASA work and that honestly was key to the success of the space program in the 60s was continuity over presidential administrations and NASA administrators over time. And just in the past, I don't know, probably 10, 12 years, we've had four or five different plans for space and exploration.
Yeah, that's been one of the issues with the Mars program specifically. There's not been a consistent long-range plan to get people to Mars from NASA's perspective. You know, there have been a few presidents who've pitched Mars programs in the past, and they've sort of faded with the next administration, largely because of funding being, you know, a huge requirement. No one wants to spend billions of dollars on space exploration when there's not really a clear case for doing so. So that lack of consistency has been one of the reasons why we've never really had a firm deadline, a major clear budget, and a plan to get people to Mars.
The thing about space, though, is that it costs a gazillion dollars. and when you've got so much that needs to be done here on Earth, just, I mean, infrastructure and figuring out healthcare and education, I mean, you name it, the roadblock always is why deal with going to other places when we've got so much to do here at home?
Yeah, that's kind of the perennial argument against space exploration as a whole. And, you know, I mean, a country has to set priorities, and it's very fair that we have plenty of other problems to address here on Earth before spending our money on Mars or back to the moon or where else we want to go. But, you know, the other argument is that these programs create a lot of jobs. They inspire a lot of people to study subjects they might otherwise not. It's hard to argue for Mars in some ways, but that's sort of beside the point, I think. A lot of people who want to go there don't feel that we need to have a motivation to go. It's let's do it. We can. We should.
Yeah, speaking of people who want to go, Elon Musk and this entire idea of American capitalism and the private sector leading the way in space now.
Yeah, that's going to be very interesting going forward. I mean, I think the new space race is actually going to be between private companies themselves and between private companies and government agencies. Looking at going to the Mars and back to the moon suddenly is now an exciting prospect too. It may be easier to make a business case for going back to the moon. There are resources there that we can mine, including helium-3, which is used in nuclear reactors. So there may be money to make on the moon. The case for Mars is not as clear. But, you know, again, Elon Musk talks about this, and he isn't looking to necessarily make money on it. It's that we can do this. And he takes a much longer view, and he says that it's important for long-term species survival, planetary protection, you know, ensuring the light of consciousness moves forward beyond Earth. And that's kind of hard to put a price tag on.
He does like to think big thoughts. So would you go, by the way, just he said the other day he wants us, you know, he's going to send two civilians on a trip around the moon. Would you go?
No, I don't think so. I mean,
you wouldn't go,
if
really?
If you told me that it was this sort of pie in the sky idea, like, oh, sure, yeah, I'll be a journalist on the moon. I'll go to the moon. But it's actually not that far out of the realm of possibility. And so when it gets a little bit more realistic, it's like, no, I don't think so.
Oh, man. I would totally go. Rebecca Boyle, she writes on science most recently for 538. Rebecca, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
I am scared as to what his life will be.
Medicaid and that CBO score is more than just dollars and cents to some people. First, though, let's do the numbers. Stocks didn't do much ahead of the Fed meeting this week. The Dow Industrials off 21 points, about a tenth percent, 20,881. The NASDAQ up 14 points, a quarter percent, 5875. The S&P 500 pretty much flat, 2373. Chipmaker Intel said it's going to pay about $15.3 billion to buy Mobileye. That's a company that makes technology for autonomous cars. Intel, also a chipmaker, down 2%. Mobileye up 28%. Ford flat. GM climbed a tenth percent. Tesla, Elon Musk's other company when he's not thinking about going to Mars, powered up 1% today. Dow Chemical said it's nearing the end of the arduous regulatory approval process for a gigantic merger with DuPont. Dow said it expects to finalize that deal for the new company, to be called, by the way, Dow DuPont in the second quarter. Dow and DuPont both up 0.4%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace. Tell a friend about a podcast you think they're going to love. Right now, think of somebody you care about. What podcast do you think they would really enjoy listening to?
And once you've got it in your head, go do this in real life. Or you could do it on social media. If they don't know how to listen to a podcast, show them how to download one. And please tell us what you recommended with the hashtag TryPod. That's T-R-Y-P-O-D. And thank you for spreading the word.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Now, some news for those of you who have ever had to deal with information on your credit report that is wrong or outdated. The Wall Street Journal reports that in July, the three main credit reporting companies, that would be Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, are going to stop putting reports of tax liens and civil judgments on some people's credit scores. Consumer advocates and some state attorneys general have been pressuring agencies to do a better job of correcting mistakes like that. From the Marketplace Bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
Consumer credit scores, known as FICO, will only include tax liens and civil judgments if that information can be verified with a person's name and address, as well as their date of birth or social security number. Chi-Chi Wu is a staff attorney at the National Consumer Law Center.
This will result in the elimination of over 90% of judgments and about half of liens from credit reports.
Since judgments and liens are public records, they mostly don't include date of birth or social security number. That's to protect consumers from identity theft. But Wu says it also means these records are easily mixed up between consumers.
You don't want the wrong consumer unjustly tagged for judgment that really didn't belong to them. That's unfair for the consumer. It's not good for the system.
Though Guy Sakala at Inside Mortgage Finance says it could also be bad for the system if lenders get credit reports that leave out liens and judgments that are accurate but can't be verified.
Lenders would rather have more information, even if some of it may be less accurate, than less information overall.
But Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics says this change just puts more responsibility for verifying consumers' credit history back where it belongs on lenders.
All too many lenders just take the score and go for it. The more the credit bureaus take out dubious information, the more important it's going to be for banks to go double-check these data, and I think that's going to make the credit system safer.
The Consumer Data Industry Association, which represents the major credit bureaus, didn't provide comment by our deadline today. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Just because paying for college and finding help in paying for college isn't nightmarish enough, FAFSA season is upon us. That's the free application for federal student aid, by the by. It's that time of year when families apply for federal and state aid to help pay for college. A couple of years ago, the IRS launched a tool that grabs tax data and fills it in right on the FAFSA. Come to find out, though, the IRS has shut that program down, saying only that it has security concerns, no specifics given. That, in turn, has sent families and school counselors scrambling because deadlines, right? Marketplace's Marielle Segarra has more.
The federal application for financial aid asks students for a lot of details, like how much did your parents pay in taxes last year? Did they take certain tax credits?
You need to have a very precise answer. You can't estimate. You need the exact number from the form.
Carrie Warwick with the National College Access Network says the tool made that easier. In the FAFSA online, you could just go get the numbers straight from the IRS. But this month, the IRS stopped offering that. It said the data could be vulnerable to identity theft. That caught college advisors like Sarah Urquidez off guard. She works with low-income high school students in Texas through the Academic Success Program. The Texas FAFSA deadline is this week, and she'd been telling families they didn't need their 2015 tax information on hand, that they could use this IRS tool.
Now we have a bunch of people that are frantically looking for tax returns or W-2s and trying to extrapolate what would have been readily available had the tool been working.
Urquidez says some students won't make the deadline.
For the ones who are really frustrated, they're going to give up.
Which means they may miss out on grants and loans and may not go to college. Justin Drager is president of the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators.
Any complexity built into applying for financial aid ultimately deters some of the very students that financial aid is designed for.
Especially families where no one has been to college before. IRS.gov says the tool will be down for several weeks. In New York, I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Remember how I said up at the top of the program that healthcare policy often comes at the expense of healthcare reality? Here's an example. As Sarah Cliff pointed out, the CBO report today says Medicaid spending, that is the health program for more than 70 million Americans, most of whom are low income or people with disabilities. The CBO says that spending is going to be cut by $880 billion over the next 10 years. That'll almost certainly mean a loss of services for millions of people. So from a health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that reality.
There's just something about Disney World that captures Scott Pivar's imagination, says his dad, Brad.
We've been to the happiest place on Earth probably 20 times or so.
Scott can't say what Disney World means to him. The 32-year-old has Fragile X syndrome, a genetic disorder that means he's nonverbal, has autistic tendencies, and the cognitive ability of a kindergartner. But his father says sometimes Scott doesn't need words.
We would go on a ride like the Thunder Mountain Railroad, And the moment we started coming down the first hill, Scott would put his arm around my neck in a death grip. And then when it's over, let's do it again.
Scott is one of about 10 million people with disabilities on Medicaid. Brad and Fern, Scott's mom, invited me to their farmhouse in upstate New York to see their morning routine.
Hey, Doodle, I have someone I want you to meet. Can you sit up for me, please?
Scott, still in his PJs, sits on his bed gazing towards the TV, a Disney cartoon. Picture books fan out across the floor.
Scott, get up. Sit up. Come on, sit up. I want you to sit up. I'd like you to meet Scott. Scott, this is Dan. Can you say hi?
Hi.
Fern's got to get Scott moving before she leaves for work. During the week, Scott spends 4.5 hours at a day program where he works on social and daily living skills. Some days, he stocks shelves at a local food pantry. Others, he practices manners at the food court in the mall. These services, and others like physical and speech therapy, aren't required under Medicaid. States have the option to offer them or not. If Congress passes this Obamacare repeal package and states lose hundreds of billions, Brad says optional services could be the first to go.
Our guys, our son, learn much slower than most people. We still see Scott change. We still see him grow. There are things that he can do today that he wasn't doing 5 years ago.
The PVARs have seen what happens when services go away. A couple of years ago, New York's Medicaid program cut physical and occupational therapy for Scott, setting back his efforts to walk up and down stairs safely and get himself dressed. Scott's development, though, is just one benefit here.
Scott to go to program allows me to go to work. If Scott's home from program, I can't do the other things that need to get done to support a family.
Hiring someone to make up those day program hours, says Fern, would cost more than she earns. Plus, her part-time job's the family's ticket to health insurance. Right now, disabled Americans like Scott make up about 15% of Medicaid enrollment and 42% of spending. That spending is already a big target for states, which have been cutting costs by creating wait lists. More than 500,000 people with disabilities were waitlisted for services in 2015, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. Fern says she's terrified for Scott's future.
I am scared as to what his life will be.
What are you scared of?
That he's going to be alone and put away somewhere and no one's going to take care of him. You're trusting someone else to take care of the most important thing in the world. And it's not going to be there.
Fern's already left for work, and Scott got distracted listening to his music. He likes oldies. Brad tugs Scott's shirt over his son's head. They're going to be late today.
Now just imagine this morning routine if it included injections and braces. We count our blessings.
Brad knows plenty of parents around the country who shoulder those kinds of responsibilities. As he steps outside, he says he's not sure what changes families like theirs will make if billions of Medicaid dollars go away. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, about which I am not certain how I feel. While the economic and healthcare policy world was concentrating on the CBO score for the Republican healthcare bill today, CBS announced late this afternoon it is picking up a new series, a prequel to The Big Bang Theory, Young Sheldon, it's called. Sheldon Cooper as a 9-year-old. Full disclosure here, I am a huge Big Bang Theory fan. Still, I don't know. Fed meeting starts tomorrow, snow permitting, and thus we have the Dow off just 21 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ up 14 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 pretty much flat. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Gurova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.